Okay, so yesterday we derived a functional differential equation which describes the scale dependence of the effective average action. And now I would like to introduce another way of thinking of this flow it induces, or this kind of differential equation, namely as a system of coupled ordinary differential equations. Well, the transition is an obvious one. You assume that in the space of all functionals, there is a certain basis denoted O alpha here. So these O alphas are a kind of basis monomials, for instance, which do not depend on K. Then you take a prefactor G alpha, a kind of generalized coupling constant, which does depend on alpha, and then you have an infinite sum to produce the most general action functional. Well, if you assume that your gamma k is of this form, then you can insert it into the flow equation. On the left-hand side, you have the ddt of this functional. This translates to a time, in quotes and quotes, time derivative of the coupling times O alpha. And on the right-hand side, there you have to do some very hard work in general. On the right-hand side, you remember there was this trace which involves the Hessian of the functional. Now you can imagine you insert this ansatz on the right-hand side, and the right-hand side, again being a functional of phi, it must be possible to expand it in terms of the basis O alpha. Let's call the expansion coefficients beta alpha. Then comparing coefficients on both sides, you see that dt g alpha is given by beta alpha, which in general depends on all these g alphas. So what you are arriving at in this manner is an infinite set of coupled ordinary differential equations. And in particular, the differential equations you are used to from perturbative field theories in perturbative renormalization are a small subset in general of these infinitely many. The standard language is to call those which you obtain for k going to infinity. These are called the Bayer parameters. They describe the Bayer action, gamma infinity, which was essentially S, while those for k close to zero are called the renormalized ones. So this is the way how you derive the component form of the exact renormalization group equation. Now in practice, this is hardly ever possible. In practice, I mentioned already, you have to rely on approximations, and one of them is the truncation of the space of all these functionals. Now, what means to truncate this flow? It means that you assume a certain form of your functional, and assuming a certain form of your functional means you expand it not in terms of a complete, whatever that means, mathematically precise, not in terms of a complete system, O alpha, but an incomplete system, OI. These OIs might just span a certain subspace of the space of all action functionals. How to choose this subspace is an art in its own. By experimentation, you have to find out what is important, what is not important. We shall come to that problem later on in more detail. We are trying to solve it, to find solutions. What we were doing here is just to rewrite the functional equation as a system of coupled ordinary equations. Up to this blue line, everything is sort of exact in the sense of you keep the most general form of the action functional. Now, yes, the G's are the prefactors, and they are called generalized couplings. They have, in many cases, the interpretation of a coupling constant. They might also have the interpretation of a wave function renormalization constant if it's in front of a kinetic term.
Laurent?
Is there some theorems in general that tells you in principle what is the space of theory you're going to explore with this equation? I'm thinking in the case of, let's say, massless theory, can you state that only polynomial local theorem would arise, or it could be?
It could be a much wider class. In particular, massless will not stay massless typically, because the cutoff as such is already a kind of mass term. It's very difficult in general to constrain the form of this gamma k. There are some special purpose-made statistical mechanics systems where you can do that, but they are very artificial, and for us there is no priori
constraint.
This is really the spirit of the Wilsonian approach. This is the Wilsonian renormalization group. But in Wilson's case, what he keeps advising us is, as you lower your cutoff and generate more and more monomials, you should also change variables. And in new variables, you would make your non-local action as local as possible, and it might look simpler then. And that's not what we are doing here in this formalism. You can change the formalism. This change of variable is also possible. But in the formulation I'm using here, in the simplest possible formulation, you always stick to this single carrier field phi, and you do not change variables or introduce auxiliary fields and so on, and therefore you have to live with non-localities. But as you say, in principle, it is always possible to make the action local with auxiliary fields. But if you think of standard, for k equals 0, we recover the standard effective action. And if you think, for instance, of the Heisenberg-Euler action in quantum electrodynamics, this is a highly non-local and non-linear action, and it would make no sense typically to linearize it by brute force. And so one attitude is, of course, it depends on the application, just to keep all the non-localities. Right.
There is the derivative with respect to phi. So,
I'm sorry, this t, I write the argument as k, but this dt means k d by dk. So I could put here also a t if you like.
Okay.
So dt is k d dk as an abbreviation for that. So, and now we are really starting doing approximations. Namely, we are trying to sort of project the flow from the big space onto a more manageable subspace. And this subspace we choose by specifying a basis OI. I runs over only a few values, whereas alpha has a much larger index set. And then this boils down to a small set with perhaps only finitely many, say, n coupled differential equations. And what one typically does in all sorts of applications, particle physics, statistical mechanics, and we shall do it in gravity also, is to study these truncated equations. Of course, perturbation theory is always possible. You also could study the full set perturbatively. This is not very much in the spirit of what we would like to do. So this is the sort of approximation method adapted to this particular quantization scheme. Now let me illustrate these ideas by means of a simple example, which nevertheless is at the heart of most standard discussions of critical phenomena, namely the so-called local potential approximation in the scalar case. Let's assume, and this is now our truncation ansatz, that the gamma k's which we allow all have the structure of a standard kinetic term which does not involve any k dependence, plus a potential which does depend on k. So this is an infinite dimensional truncation subspace which we describe in this manner, and the infinitely many couplings are the coordinates, so to speak, which parameterize a general function u of phi. So now, by means of this simple example, let me explain in some details how you go from the truncation ansatz to the explicit differential equation, because this step reappears over and over again in later applications. And in fact, it is this step which is that the hardest work in this business always. So given this ansatz, I mean, here everything is pretty simple, so you will find it rather trivial. Given this ansatz, first of all, you can compute its Hessian. This superscript 2 denotes the formal matrix of second functional derivatives. So this gives in an operator language minus box from the kinetic term, and then the second derivative of this function, ordinary derivative with respect to phi, and phi is inserted. So this Hessian functionally depends on the field. Now we have to insert this ansatz, this and this, into our flow equation. This is the exact equation. Now, the step which is to be done here is this expansion I mentioned, the expansion of the right-hand side in terms of the OIs, these basis functionals, namely those of that form. In fact, the only output you expect from this equation is a differential equation for this function rather than functional uk. Now, how do you do that? The idea is to insert this gamma 2 on the right-hand side, and then you would somehow like to project out this function or this class of functionals from the space of all functionals. Well, how is that? How can this be achieved? This term here is the only one which is non-zero. If you insert, if you think in terms of a derivative expansion, this is the non-derivative term. It's the only one non-zero when you insert a constant field. So let's insert a constant field, its value is a number phi, into this equation. Then here appears a constant. On the left-hand side, you have the scale derivative here, k d dk acting on uk, the volume. You pull out this constant, x-independent constant from the volume element. On the right-hand side, you have now the problem of computing the trace of an operator, which is a function of box, but it does not depend on x any longer. And that is easy now, because you can immediately evaluate the trace in a plane wave basis. So you go to momentum space, the trace becomes a momentum integral, box is replaced by p squared, and what you get is this expression, or in polar coordinates with these abbreviations calling p squared w, you finally end up with this equation. Now this is again a partial differential equation, but a pretty simple one. It's a partial differential equation for a function and not a functional anymore. There is still this integral on the right-hand side for specific choices of RK. You can evaluate it explicitly. For others, you can't. And
can you remind what condition implies this equation?
It is the assumption that for all K, the functional gamma K has this form. So functionals of this form span a certain subspace, and if I project the flow onto that subspace, then the k dependence of u is governed by this equation. And since we have this interpolation between bare and standard effective action, this u interpolates between the classical potential and the standard effective potential. Now just to I'm not going to talk much about scalars. You could, there is a whole industry of investigations based upon this equation. Basically, all of critical phenomena theory you can derive and explore by looking at, for instance, scaling solutions of this equation and so on. Just in one transparency, I would like to convince you of the fact that solving this equation amounts to something which is actually by far more than doing perturbation theory. Namely, from standard discussions, you know that in perturbation theory it's notoriously difficult, or actually it's impossible, in the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking, to show that the effective potential is convex. We know at k equals zero, gamma, the ordinary gamma, or the ordinary effective potential in this LPA, is a convex functional or function because it's a Legendre transform, and every Legendre transform is convex. So at k equals zero, we expect the ordinary effective potential to be convex. Now let's assume that at some high scale, which you will send to infinity ultimately, you have a shape of the potential like this, a W-shape potential as in Higgs, for the Higgs mechanism. So this is the classical potential, or U infinity. And if you do the standard one-loop calculations, for instance, in order to compute the one-loop effective potential, you still would not get, you somehow do corrections to this form, but you don't get something convex. And now if you insert this kind of potential at the high scale, at infinity, sort of, use it as an initial condition for this partial differential equation, and then turn the crank and run the evolution down to k equals zero, what happens is shown here. First of all, these parts on the left and right move in. So this thing here is the original one, and this bottom goes down. Some steps for not too small values of k are shown in this numerical simulation here. Ultimately, if you run it further, you see that this bare potential is evolved into this effective potential. And this is really a convex function, and the flat bottom here describes spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this little partial differential equation is capable of producing this flat bottom, describes spontaneous symmetry breaking, but in finite order perturbation theory, you would not be able to see that.
What is effective potential? Is it defined by this?
The effective potential?
Or is it something else that is in the statement that this limit is something else?
The effective potential is the non-derivative part of the ordinary effective action. And the ordinary effective action, this is what people used for many years. That is our limit for k. Exactly as I did, but they omit the cutoff term. The formulas are all the same except for the cutoff term. And so in the limit of k equals zero, we recover the standard effective potential in that sense. And this is the object people always are trying to get, but with perturbation theory you would not get it convex.
What is the physical sense of
the sense is that it tells you that you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. If you look at the expectation value and follow it, it moves inward and then it stops here. What it tells you is that you have a spontaneously broken, I mean, if you think of let's say you have it in with a two component field, really a Mexican hat potential, then this means that you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking. Because the expectation value is given by this point. The expectation value of the field is given by this phi value.
With respect to that, because the bottom is flat, in some sense the X condensate seems to have no longer a pressure.
One has to be careful. You have to look for every finite value of k, there is a little bump in between. And if you look at the limit has a well-defined location. The limit of the expectation value is at that point.
In some sense, you need an infrared cutoff somewhere.
Yes, k is the infrared cutoff. Right, and then exactly, and then you have a little bump in between that you can deal show even analytically. So the field stops running at that point. So it moves. It comes from out far out, and then it moves in, and then it stops. And that point where it stops, you can show is the phi value assumed in the limit k going to zero. No. It's actually the other way around. The fact that the bottom becomes flat, this is due to the fact, just precisely this mechanism that you have tunneling through the barrier. You tunnel through the barrier, so you have a certain probability of finding the field at a phi value here. The fact that it's possible to find the phi value here means the potential cannot be different from zero. So the flat bottom in physical terms means you have tunneling through the barrier. And in lattice simulations, you really see that. Okay, that was just a little toy application in the scalar case. And for one more remark, I would like to continue with the scalar situation. I am now going to introduce a concept which in the context of the scalar model is close to absolutely trivial, but it will play a very important role in gauge theories, in particular in gravity. Namely, in gravity, background independence is a very important issue, and in order to introduce the idea of how this is implemented in the average action approach, let us reformulate the problem of quantizing the scalar field in a somewhat different way. Namely, first of all, we had to integrate about this microscopic field chi. That was the variable of integration in our functional integral. Now let's fix some arbitrarily prescribe background field chi b. That's just introduced by hand. It's a given fixed field, fixed once and forever. And the difference between the two we call f, the fluctuation field. There is no expansion. We don't assume that f is small. It's not small. It's just the difference of these two fields. And now let's define a closely related but different generating functional from what we had before. It has this superscript b for background. Namely, now we integrate over df. This d is a translation invariant measure, so d chi is df. Here in the classical action, we insert chi b plus f for the total chi. And now two changes occur. First of all, I couple only the fluctuation to the source, so differentiating with respect to f generates f correlators, and I do not cut off the fluctuations of the full field, but what I do cut off is the modes of the f. So this is just a definition. And in fact, this is the sort of the prototype of the kind of a functional integral we shall use in Yang-Mills and gravity theories later on. And now with this definition, let's continue as before. We define an average f bar, the expectation value is the functional derivative with respect to j at a fixed, it's always fixed, value of the background. Assuming you can solve this source field relationship, we get J, the source, as a functional of the average fluctuation, and parametrically this solution depends on the background field. Now we do the Legendre transformation as before, and we subtract off the classical cutoff term, so to speak, the suppression term with the classical fields inserted. So this is the, this first line was the gamma tilde yesterday, and the whole thing is the gamma now, gamma b, because of background. So that's just the definition, and along the same lines as yesterday, you can derive a flow equation. That's the flow equation. Here, what appears on the right-hand side is the Hessian of gamma b with respect to f bar at fixed background. And via the functional, the integral differential equation, you can show that the background object at infinity is the classical action with the shifted field. Very easy. Now, again, a step you know. Well, f bar was the expectation value of f, and the full chi expectation value we denote phi again. So microscopically, we had a decomposition of phi into background plus fluctuation. At the macroscopic or classical or expectation value level, this becomes phi is the classical background plus f bar. Nothing intelligent said so far. And again, nothing intelligent is to follow here. Instead of considering gamma b a functional of f bar and chi, it is sometimes more natural to consider it a functional of phi and chi b, because the background and the full field are, well, in a sense, the complete field, whereas f is a difference. In Yang-Mills theory, phi and chi b are both gauge fields, whereas this is a homogeneously transforming object. So in a sense, these two are closer in spirit. So let's just define this object with a comma here. Here was a, it was a semicolon with a big point here. That is the object we are going to study now. In particular, we can look at a special case of this functional. We can put both of these arguments equal to obtain a new functional gamma bar. It depends only on one complete field, phi, so it's the old one, phi comma phi, or written differently, the old one with the fluctuation average put to zero and the background put equals to phi. So this is important to understand. This argument of gamma bar is the background. Originally it was the background while the average fluctuation is zero. And what I'm going to claim now is that this gamma bar contains the same physical information as the object we defined yesterday in the non-background approach. By some very trivial manipulations, you can find the following relationship between gamma b, this background object, and the gamma of the standard non-background approach, the one we discussed yesterday. Namely, what you find is the gamma b of f bar, semicolon chi b, is just the old one with the shifted argument inserted. And in particular, if you, or not in particular, if you use this different notation with a phi instead of f bar dependence, then this object is just the old object for every chi b. So this is totally trivial. And what you also can read off from here is if you equate phi and chi b to get this gamma bar functional, then the gamma bar b functional is the same object as the one from the non-background formalism. This you can prove, for instance, by showing that these two functionals, the left-hand side and the right-hand side, satisfy the same integral differential equation. This, the proof is totally trivial. But this equality has an important consequence. Namely, it means that if you differentiate gamma bar with respect to phi, you get the same Green's functions as differentiating the standard gamma with respect to phi. This is obvious and trivially clear from this construction. But so there is no, if you know the result, it is not surprising that these two functionals are equivalent. But conceptually, there is a great, a big change in the interpretation of the argument of the generating functional, namely gamma bar. This argument here originated from the background dependence. So the statement is, if you know how the functional depends on the background, then it is sufficient to know it at f bar equals zero, and you know everything you would like to know. Now, in this special case of a scalar, this is, as I said, a totally trivial statement, and you can prove it in 5 minutes. But this observation will be the key ingredient for the constructions in gravity and Yang-Mills theory. We shall discuss gravity only here. There are two complications which, however, do not spoil this statement I just made. One is you need a gauge fixing, but luckily there is a gauge fixing technology, and in fact this is known as the background gauge fixing technique invented by De Witt and Hooft and others, well known in standard perturbative quantum gravity, which just fits into this framework and keeps this simplicity I mentioned. And the other complication is that RK will depend on the background in general. Nevertheless, it continues to be true that background independence, somewhat paradoxically, can be achieved by just this strategy. Namely, the strategy which we shall follow is you fix an arbitrary background, you quantize the dynamical degrees of freedom in this background, and then you adjust your background after having done this quantization in such a way that the average fluctuation vanishes. And if you then know how your functional depends on this KB, then you know everything you would like to know. So this was the sort of general philosophical introduction to the, first of all, technology of the effective average action, and then this specific implementation in a background formalism. This background formalism for a scalar theory, you don't need it really, but now it will become important for gravity. So the next chapter is the construction, the analogous construction of an exact evolution equation or a normalization group equation for gravity. Now the main new aspect appearing here is, as I said, gauge invariance. And so we have to face the problems of gauge fixing. And I should say, if we had more time, we could now have an intermediate section on Yang-Mills theory, applying these methods to Yang-Mills theory. This technique for gravity is very analogous to what is done in Yang-Mills theory in the background gauge. But now it's basically just a matter of notation. Let's start with gravity right away. Let's forget about the cutoff term for a moment. Let's just assume we are given a formal path integral over all metrics microscopic matrix, we denote them gamma mu nu, and S is some diffeomorphism invariant action functional, so delta gamma changes under the action of some generating vector field V by its Lie derivative written here. Now this is a kind of gauge invariance, and we would like now to gauge fix this path integral, but in a very specific way. Namely, the same problem occurs in Yang-Mills theory. If you now would take just any gauge breaking or gauge fixing term and would follow the usual steps of defining generating functionals, then your gamma of g mu nu, the effective action, even the ordinary effective action, would not be a gauge invariant, that is diffeomorphism invariant functional of g mu nu. This is well known in standard, for instance, in particle physics, in a standard gauge, the gamma of the classical gauge field you construct is not a gauge invariant functional of its argument. But that's not what we want. We would like to be the effective action and also the effective average action to be a gauge invariant functional of g mu nu. And the way out is precisely the so-called background gauge fixing condition. What you do here is what we just did in the scalar case, namely the first step is you decompose the metric as a classical fixed background G bar plus a fluctuation, and the measure is then dH. And again, H mu nu is not supposed to imply anything like being small or being expanded in H mu nu is not small. And now comes the crucial idea due to De Witt and Toft and others, namely the choice of a very smart gauge fixing term. The gauge fixing term is of the following type. It depends on H and it depends on the background. Volume element with G bar mu nu, and then here is a vector F mu depending on H and G bar. And the class, actually it's a whole class of gauge fixing terms which have the good, let's say, good background properties are those where under a combined diffeomorphism, combined in the sense both G bar and H changes by its Lie derivative, this F mu transforms as a vector. So this is the condition. I will show you an example in a moment. F transforms as a vector under the combined transformation. Now you might ask, well, if the gauge fixing term seems to behave so nicely under diffeomorphisms, how does it break the gauge invariance? And the answer is, this is not the gauge transformation which we actually have to fix. Namely, as I told you, G bar is fixed once and for all in the quantization process. So the diffeomorphisms which have the status of a gauge transformation in this context is this set of transformations. Can you see it really everywhere? This set where G bar is kept the same and all the change is carried by H. So the Lie derivative of G bar plus H, that's the change of H. And this transformation is broken by that gauge fixing term. So these are the true, or some people call it quantum gauge transformations. They are fixed, but if you also, besides age, also change the background, then it is invariant. That's the magic property you require from this gauge fixing term. And all the good properties of the construction will come from this property. Now, having adopted this choice, you go on as always. You, in our case, it is sufficient to play the standard Fadeev-Popov trick. By the standard recipe, you construct the ghost action. That's always done in the same way. C bar is the anti-ghost, C is the ghost. This is the ghost action. And how do you get it? Well, the gauge fixing condition is sort of F mu equals zero. And the structure of the Fadeev-Popov action is always the same. You have the variation of the gauge condition under the symmetry transformation. You replace the generating the parameter you replace by a ghost and you multiply by an anti-ghost. It's the same as in Yang-Mills. And this object is the variation of f under this transformation. So df by dh, and then this is the variation of h, this expression. So this is the variation of f times the anti-ghost. And here, the vector field is the ghost. Ghosts have an upper index, are vector fields, anti-ghosts are the are forms.
So what about those gauge transformations which don't preserve gamma by a g bar?
These?
Right.
This
why
is
why
in...
Well,
this is a matter of taste. I mean, you can call them, some people call this background gauge transformations and this quantum gauge transformations, but there is no unique terminology. But the question you are asking is, what happens when I apply these transformations to the ghost action? And the answer is, it is invariant. So both the gauge fixing term and the ghost action are invariant under this transformation. Yes?
When you choose the measure, the functional measure, you state that the functional integral over g mu nu chromatic is equal to the functional integral over the equation.
Yes, df.
So assuming that this decomposition invariant matrix is transformational invariant.
Yes, that is assumed, but this is another beautiful property of this flow equation business. These measure issues are sort of very harmless because switching from one measure to another just shifts the initial condition for the flow equation, and the flow equation does not depend, at least not naively, on the choice of the measure. But you are right, I assume it's translation invariant, and for instance, we were applying it to Liouville theory also with a conformally or Weyl invariant measure, and there you have to take special means. So here it's always the translation invariant case. Now to make things a bit more concrete, let me show you an example you all know in this language, namely, let's choose this f mu in this funny way. There is a strange constant, just ignore it. Then an operator, calligraphic f, depending on g bar, and this operator acts on h alpha beta, and the operator is this one, g bar inverse, and the covariant derivative with the Christoffel symbols from g bar. And this choice, this is the one we were usually using, this choice is nothing but a background version of the harmonic coordinate condition. If you put g bar equals to Kronecker delta alpha beta flat space, then the condition f mu equals zero is nothing but the standard harmonic coordinate condition. So this is a convenient choice. You can verify or see it immediately if you change g bar and h. You transform g bar and h tensorially, then this object obviously transforms as a vector. So it is background invariant. But it fixes the true quantum gauge transformations, and that you can see by computing the ghost action, C bar, then there is a matrix C. This matrix looks like this, G bar and gamma appear here, and that it fixes the gauge. To verify that, you must show that this is a non-singular operator, and in fact it is. So this is basically the same as you would do in perturbation theory. I've not told you anything new here. What's also exactly like in perturbation theory is that the sum of the classical action, the ghost action, and the gauge fixing action are BRST invariant. This is the BRS transformation. Delta changes essentially as it does classically, but the generating vector field is replaced by the ghost, and epsilon is a Grassmann odd parameter. G bar doesn't change at all, so this is the BRS version of the true quantum gauge transformations, the ghosts have this kind of C structure, constant C, right hand side, and the anti-ghost transforms into F mu. There are versions with an auxiliary field where this transforms into the auxiliary field, if you are familiar with this formalism, but that's not crucial. We can just live with this kind of structure.
Is it a good time for break?
Yes, very good time.